All righty. Sorry to interrupt the news. We have, hopefully, live on air here with KSDP, Matthew Cronin. Welcome to the airwaves, Matthew. We got you on the other line.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, this is Virgil Porter, and today we will be speaking with Matthew Cronin. He is a research professor of animal genetics at the Department of High Latitude Agriculture with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I believe you're based at the Matanuska Experimental Farm in Palmer. Is that correct, Matthew?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's where my office is. I work in Anchorage a lot, too, because I work with the resource industry folks and some of the DNR Fish and Game and Governor's Office people, too, on resource issues, natural resource issues.
Well, I have looked through some of your selected papers you have on your UAF website, and I saw some of your research cited in the ongoing story that's happening right now concerning some cattle on one of our neighboring islands to the west a little bit, Woznesensky. But your research applies to the Shirikof Island herd, which is a little bit southwest of Kodiak. Before we get into that, I wanted to go through a little bit of your background. You have a bachelor's of science out of, the State University of New York College of Environmental Science, a master's of science of biology out of Montana State University, and a PhD out of Yale. Now, through that roundabout transit, how did you end up in Alaska?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. After my bachelor's degree, and this is back in the 70s, dating myself, which was in forestry school back in New York, where I am from, Connecticut and New York. After my bachelor's degree, I worked a few years in forestry and then joined the Coast Guard and was a Coast Guard officer who got stationed in Anchorage and spent a lot of time out in the Aleutians, western Alaska, on the North Slope with just marine law enforcement, whether it was oil pollution or foreign vessels. And back then, during the Cold War, we had the responsibility of monitoring vessels from the Soviet bloc and so forth. So that's how I got to Alaska. Then I left for graduate school and was offered a job with Fish and Wildlife in 1989 and came back, and I've been here since. I left Fish and Wildlife in 92, was in the private sector until 04 when I joined the university.
Well, at least you got to see Alaska from the right point of view, on the deck of a boat.
Well, yeah, a lot of time in small planes out in western Alaska, as you can imagine. And I really respect what the folks do out there for a living, because it's not easy.
Well, bringing us to the current topic, some of your current research programs, population genetics of wildlife species, including polar bears, brown bears, wolves, bison, and marine mammals. We're actually looking at some feral cattle. Now, your publication, your research paper from 2007 published an animal genetics titled Genetic Relationships Between Feral Cattle from Shirikof Island, Alaska, and Other Breeds. How did you become interested in the Shirikof Island cattle and decide to pursue research concerning their genetics?
Well, I had started in graduate school working on genetics using DNA, which in the 80s was coming into the technology was becoming available. So working with DNA on natural populations, wildlife populations, I, looking at the literature, realized that the domestic livestock folks were decades ahead of studying wild animals, as you can imagine, because you have experimental control. You have a family of cattle or mice, if you're a laboratory researcher. You have a family that you can do crosses and actually know the relationships and then compare that with DNA. In wild populations, you're guessing. You know, the guys who do the fish stock identification, which some of your listeners are probably familiar with, identifying salmon stocks with DNA, I started off doing some of that work. And it's all the basically the same technology and concepts. As you look at relationships from two individual animals to populations to species. So So you can compare Chinook and Coho, or you can compare stocks of Coho going into different river systems. So by working with the livestock genetics people, I became familiar with the literature and the incredible technical expertise of livestock people, both genetics and husbandry. And so started working with them. And then in 2004, the issue of Chirikov cattle came up that the Fish and Wildlife wanted them off the island because it's part of the National Wildlife Refuge. And the state government wanted them to stay, the governor's office anyway. And so there was a controversy over whether they were worth it and so forth. So we got some tissues from the guy that got some off the island and just did a standard DNA comparison with cattle breeds. And that resulted in that paper that you're talking about from 2007.
And that was actually in collaboration with a federal agency, the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, the Agricultural Research Service. So this was, you know, hand in hand with some of the federal entities.
Exactly. I got to know federal and university researchers in livestock, cattle in particular, and just started collaborating with them. And they were interested or amused, I guess, at people working with moose or elk or bears. But, of course, they found it interesting. So we started working together on projects, and the Chirikov cows was a natural to go into the studies that were already being done comparing cattle breeds, the breeds that are used commercially.
Now, I wanted to move on. In this paper, and just for everyone, if anyone wants to read this paper, it's available on Matthew's website at UAF. It's also linked at apradio.org. I have a link straight to the PDF. And thank you for making those available. These academic papers are sometimes hard to acquire or get a copy of, or you have to have a subscription. And so it's great that you're sharing this research.
Just to keep in mind, if you try to Google me, Google School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences, UAF, and that will direct you, so then you can click on faculty, staff, and so forth, if because the website address is kind of long and hard to remember.
Well, we put one up on the radio station's website, and hopefully people will be able to check it out directly. But I wanted to say, in the introduction to this paper concerning the Chirikov cattle, you note, interest in sustainable livestock production systems may cause shifts from improved breeds to adapted breeds that are more biologically fit in low-input production systems and harsh environments. That means it wouldn't take so much resources to actually bring a cow to full growth. Now, is this a statement about the Chirikov breed's ability to adapt and thrive in such a unique place?
Well, it's not talking about them that we have evidence of that. But the idea that there's cattle that are surviving in a feral state without any protection or husbandry, including feeding, suggests that they will be under a strong selection pressure for whatever, whether it's being able to produce calves and raise them in that environment, if it's being able to digest the forage that's available, and so on. That would require a lot of in-depth study that we didn't do. We looked at fairly simple genetics. But in general, cattle breeds are fitted to their environment. There's a certain amount of hobby interest as well. But, for example, as you go from south to north in the U.S., you see the frequency of Brahma cow characteristics decrease slowly from South Texas, where they run Brahma cows or Santa Gertrudis or other variations, to where you see their influence slowly decreasing as you go north to where you get straight European and usually British breeds like Angus and Hereford.
Go ahead.
So what I'm saying is different breeds have been selected both for different properties as well as different environments.
Now, are there modern commercial breeds of cattle able to survive in such a environment, in such a climate like Chirikov Island out there with no husbandry?
Well, evidently, because they've been there for, I guess, over 100 years, depending on which historical records you look at.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a pure breed, I mean, you could try, you know, Scotch Highland or even Angus or something and see if they have what it takes to survive on their own. But, you know, when you have a population that is probably resource limited, meaning the amount of food available is limited at some point when you get to some population number. There's selection going on for feed efficiency and overall survival. It's a good bet.
Right. So there's some adaptation, some selective breeding that's gone on of, you know, just the basic survival out there, left to their own accord, and maybe they've bred to adapt.
Yeah, we can infer that. Let's say we can hypothesize that. I'm very careful to not invoke selection just because when you're dealing with wild populations, if you don't do the experimentation, you don't know it. It's speculating. There's nothing wrong with that. You just have to qualify that we don't know they're locally adapted, but it's probably a good bet after 100 years living on an island of limited area in a fairly cool and harsh climate that they'd be have undergone some selection to that environment.
I understand. Moving on, we'll go from the introduction to the conclusion. Your paper's conclusion states clearly, and this is a quote, clearly the Chirikov Island population is unique and differentiated from contemporary commercial beef germplasm widely available in North America. Thus, the Chirikov Island population represents a novel genetic resource that may be of importance for conservation and industry. But moving on from that quote, what would be the impacts of this genetic resource being eradicated?
Okay, well, first let me qualify that conclusion is in the context of domestic livestock. So I'm not claiming, like the wildlife people often do, that this is a totally unique and cool thing we have to conserve for biodiversity or some other aesthetic sort of wildlife issue. What me and my co-authors are saying is, compared to the other commercial breeds, these animals are genetically different, and we quantified that. And therefore, they may be of use as domestic livestock. So we're not claiming they're wild and should be treated as wild, endangered species, and all that stuff. We're simply saying that to the producers, you know, if you look at the numbers, which I won't bore you with a lot, but the difference of the Chirikov cows from the other breeds, Angus, Charolais, Hereford, Highland, Limousin, Red Angus, Saleur, Shorthorn, Simmental, Territes, and Texas Longhorn, is about 0.4, just a measure we use. But the difference between Hereford and Angus is also about 0.4. So the Chirikov cows are uniformly different from the European breeds. They're actually American populations of the European origin breeds. But some breeds are just about as different from each other. So they're not totally different from other cows like, you know, a different species would be. However, their differentiation is enough from the breeds that they constitute a genetically different resource, which is expected because they've been isolated for a long time and started from a relatively small number of animals. So if you were to lose them, if let's say they all died or nobody ever went out and got any and they just kind of sat there, if you lost them from the domestic livestock gene pool, we don't know what we'd be losing. That's part of the, I think, the interest on the part of livestock folks is who knows whether either production-wise or hardiness or even just marketing that their background, their history, is a very powerful marketing tool because people want more natural and more organic-type food these days.
All right. Now, moving on, there's been discussion that this breed on Chirikov may have substantial genetic lineage from the endangered Siberian Yakut cattle. Could you elaborate on this? I saw in the study they were not, that sample wasn't included in comparison.
Yeah, well, you know, the most, from my perspective, the most three important words in science are I don't know. I don't know. There have been some Yakut cattle and other Eurasian breeds looked at with the same genes we looked at back in 07. But I really can't tell you how the Chirikov cows would compare with them. The idea being that some Russian cattle were brought during the Russian colonial period that ended up on Chirikov. I think it's documented there were Russian cattle at Kenai and Kodiak and other places. So the idea that there may be some Siberian cattle, whether from Yakut or other parts of Siberia, is an interesting hypothesis that we simply didn't test. We can, if we can get our hands on some Siberian DNA, Siberian cattle DNA, and there are collaborators we might be able to do that with, but we haven't as of now.
Well, now moving on to collaboration and, you know, and obtaining research samples, have you considered conducting genetic research on cattle breeds that are living and thriving in similar environments? And, you know, because we have some out here, they've got them on various islands out going out towards the west. And if so, and this is even including the bison here on the island that the Shumigan Corporation manages. And takes care of. Now, how would one of the tribal corporations or members or somebody permitted to take some of these one of these animals? How would they get you a sample, and what would you need if you were interested?
Yeah, well, first, I am interested both for the cattle or the bison. Right now, I'm sort of immersed in studies of wolves and polar bears, and to a lesser extent, sea lions, because of the endangered species listings that are resulting in certain amount of restriction of our industry friends in either fishing, oil mining, logging, and so on. So that's been my priority. However, getting samples from the cattle or the bison in other Alaska locations would be highly desirable. And I have collaborators both with federal USDA, who are really solid guys, and the University of Missouri, among others, who have the DNA lab to do this stuff. For DNA, that is, if we're just going to compare a cattle or a bison population with others, if you take just a small piece of muscle, meat, and freeze it, and then send it to me with the species, location, date, sex, and maybe age, or you could take a piece of non-tanned skin, that's okay. Like, the hide is not so great on the belly of ungulates. That's work with wolves. We've taken little pieces from trappers. And that can be air-dried and kept dry. But meat can be sent cool if it's within a few days of harvest, or frozen is okay, and it could be shipped to... easiest thing is to ship it to me here in Anchorage. For actual germplasm, that is semen for artificial insemination, which is big industry in cattle, and it's been done on bison too. That's a little harder, and my USDA colleagues say if you would just get in entire testicles from the scrotum and keep them at refrigerator temperature, don't let it freeze. It'd have to be FedEx because we have to get it to them quickly, and they extract sperm from the ducts and in the testes, and that would probably take a little bit more effort and coordination. But for simple DNA comparisons, which is what we're hoping to do more of with the 24 Chirikov DNA samples we already have, just a piece of muscle or skin, and just keep it cool, or the muscle can be frozen.
Well, I'll get that information from you after this interview, and we can post it up on apradio.org. And if so, you might get some contact from some folks out here that are managing some of these animals and harvesting some of them for subsistence.
Yeah, you know, Virgil, the other thing you can do if you're not killing, if you're handling animals in shoots and so on, when you take if you put an ear tag in, the punch from the ear, the piece of ear tissue, is really good because it dries quickly, it doesn't degrade, it's got muscle and skin. Those are real good. We've used those with grizzly bears with very good success.
Well, moving on, because I had mentioned the bison. Now, we're going to step away from the cattle and move on to a more recent paper. You had forwarded this to me, and I'd seen it listed as well, from 2013, published in the Journal of Heredity. This is titled Genetic Variation and Differentiation of Bison, Subspecies, and Cattle, Bos taurus, Breeds and Subspecies. Now, it looks like you compared some of, you know, the two subspecies of bison. You have the plains bison and the wood bison. Bison and bison athabasca. Athabasca. And from what I read, and of course I am not a scientist and I cannot state these conclusions, but it sounds like there's a lot of similarity between the two subspecies, and there might not be that much of a difference between the two. Any comment on that?
Yeah, that's our conclusion, and we aren't the first ones to find that. I actually found it back in 1986 in my master's thesis that the kind of DNA called mitochondrial DNA was not different between wood bison and plains bison. And then other people through the 90s and 2000s have explicitly stated wood bison and plains bison are not different genealogically, let's say. To be different subspecies, you have to have different genealogies, or we call them phylogeny is the technical term. And because they're the same species, of course, they can interbreed. And wood bison and plains bison, historically, when Europeans got to North America, their ranges were probably contiguous. That is, they ran into each other. So some bison extended up into the boreal forest of northwestern Canada, and I guess until a few hundred years ago, even into eastern Alaska. And then they were decimated like the plains bison down south. So then you had wood bison isolated from the plains bison after the decimation of the herds. But then in 1928, the Canadian government took 6,700 plains bison and put them into Wood Buffalo Park, which contained the last 2,000 wood bison. Yes, those numbers are documented. So how can they be different if they were mixed at that level? Well, when we did the genetics, the other plains bison herds from around the country do indeed look somewhat different from the wood bison. This is for a whole bunch of genes. But plains bison look different from other plains bison. So they don't fall out as two distinct groups, plains and wood. They fall out basically as different herds based on their histories. So my conclusion is wood bison do not deserve subspecies status, but they can be treated as a Northwest North American population, just like we manage moose or deer in different areas as different management units.
So now explain to me. I'm not sure how these subspecies get delineated, how the terminology actually changes in the realm of scientific classification. Are you proposing to merge this, or is this just adding another voice to the chorus that maybe the delineation isn't necessary? Because even in the paper, it mentions that there's not even as much genetic variation between the two subspecies of bison as there are in breeds of cattle.
Well, exactly, and that's why we did that comparison. I am not formally suggesting that the subspecies be abandoned, but as a researcher, I'm presenting data that do not support them being different subspecies. In other words, a formal taxonomic assessment would be exactly that. You would write a formal taxonomic assessment and get it sanctioned probably by the American Society of Mammalogists and basically look to get a consensus of the people who do what's called taxonomy classification. And that would take a certain amount of effort that I haven't gone through because I just haven't. Now, the reason it's important is because the wood bison are on the U.S. endangered species list, just like the western stock of sea lions out in western Alaska. And the plains bison are not, even though the environmental groups have petitioned to make that so. So because they're on the endangered species list, the state of Alaska, which has wood bison, they're being held at Portage at the Wildlife Center there. The governors won't allow them to be released because if they are, then the people where they're released, which is the interior, will then be under federal restriction what they can do on their land, whether it's state or private land. Just like you couldn't cut trees because of the spotted owl, or sometimes fishing is restricted because of the sea lion. So the governor is watching out for, this is Murkowski, Palin, and now Parnell, because they're watching out for the state citizens and our rights, property rights and other rights, they are not putting an endangered species out onto the landscape because they know it means regulation by the federal government. Now, the state's trying to negotiate with the feds different exclusions called 4D rules and so forth that are technical endangered species deals, and fishing games trying to do a good job and get it so we can have the bison but not the ESA restrictions. But it's a very difficult process because there's lawsuits from environmental groups and so on. But Alaska Fish and Game is trying to work it out so we can have both. We can have the bison, but we don't have the unreasonable restrictions that the Endangered Species Act can bring about.
Now, moving on, you had mentioned those are wood bison. Now, does in Portage, at that, you know, where they've got all the various wild animals, do they just have wood bison? Because we had, there was a couple that were dropped on Popoff and added to the herd here. So I wasn't sure. I mean, are you familiar with this herd and what they are made up of? Or maybe they just introduced wood bison to it as well?
No, my understanding is that it's the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center in Portage. My understanding is they took their plains bison and sent them, I guess some of them out there and maybe other places. So they only have wood bison in Portage now. But they kept them in separate pastures because I remember I used to drive in and the plains bison were in one pasture and the wood in another. But my understanding is they dispersed the plains bison to focus on having only wood bison there now.
All righty. And so, yeah, I guess that would probably lead to the mystery that was in my mind of the herd out here, I guess, are plains bison. Because if there was wood, it would probably lead to some endangered species awkwardness.
Well, yeah. I mean, what's interesting is the way the wood bison herd started here was a private rancher in Delta went to Canada, bought about 15 head from a private guy. They're endangered species in Canada, but they allow in Canada the private ranchers to raise them because obviously it makes more of them. So the guy in Delta brought him back to Alaska. Well, Fish and Wildlife went and confiscated and charged him with crimes and fined him and took the bison from him. And then they ended up in state jurisdiction in Portage. And then the state brought more in after that for this proposed reintroduction.
Huh.
Yeah, so I guess without permits, you're not allowed to own endangered species is what the lesson is.
All righty. Well, I will, after this, I will contact you and get some mailing addresses and some procedures if any of the entities or people that are taking care of some of the cattle and bison out here, you know, if to get you samples, you know, be it, you know, something for a DNA analysis or something for the germoplast was the term?
Well, yeah, germplasm means sperm or eggs. Germ meaning reproductive cells, so
right.
Either sperm or eggs in females will be considered, quote, germ plasm is the technical term.
Well, I'm quite sure that, yeah, there's some folks that, and, you know, even some of the local corporations that would want to assist you, and, you know, if, because they are under their care right now, and so they might be able to contribute something. Mr. Cronin, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for taking some time out and talking with us here at KSDP, the Aleutians Eastboro.
Okay, well, thank you, Virgil, and all your listeners. Especially, I'd like to thank all the folks in the private sector that let us university and public sector guys work, because we know you're the ones producing the wealth and the hard work out there. So thanks a lot.
All righty. Thank you, Mr. Cronin, and I'm going to let you enjoy the rest of your day. I appreciate the talk.
Okay, talk to you soon, Virgil. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Dr. Matthew Cronin, research professor for UAF. We will have an updated entry on the website with this interview and some contact information in case anybody picks up a buffalo during the hunting season and wants to send him a sample for his archives and his research.